KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
It was literally a major sort of epiphany, really, that I'd just been playing this 3.5-foot ring junkie, and now I'm going to be playing a 25-foot gorilla. This is surely the end of typecasting.
Actor Andy Serkis was a pioneer of performance capture. Playing Gollum in the Lord of the Rings films and the title character in King Kong opened his eyes to a new world of possibility. Now Serkis has gone behind the camera, directing the new film Breathe, an old-fashioned love story about triumph over adversity. Breathe is based on the life of Robin Cavendish, who was stricken with polio in 1958 and paralyzed from the neck down. He became a powerful advocate for the rights of the severely disabled. Serkis came to the project through his business partner, Jonathan Cavendish, and this wasn't just another script. Breathe tells the inspiring story of Jonathan Cavendish's remarkable parents. But first on the news banter, Hollywood is still obsessed with the downfall of Harvey Weinstein and Amazon Studios chief Roy Price. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my ally in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So this has been quite a couple of weeks in Hollywood. The fallout from the Harvey Weinstein scandal still continuing. It helped me, actually, in a story that I had been trying to break for quite a while. I had a source, Issa Hackett. She's the daughter of Philip K. Dick, the author and the producer of Man in the High Castle. She had alleged that Roy Price, the head of Amazon Studios, had aggressively and lewdly harassed her in a cab ride from a dinner to a party at Comic-Con in July 2015. And once women started coming forward in the Harvey Weinstein case, she had been reluctant to go on the record. She still has big business at Amazon, lots of people who work for her shows and depend on that. She didn't want this to sort of infuse the environment among her staff and make people feel strange around Amazon. But she decided, and she was emboldened in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein of the women coming forward, you know, from Gwyneth Paltrow and Rosanna Arquette to all sorts of, I mean, 1 hour at this point. She went on the record and told me her story for the first time on the record. I've been talking to her for months. And within a very short time, Roy Price was no longer running Amazon Studios.
Yeah, he was suspended in the hours after the original interview posted. And then about 2 hours after I called Amazon and said we were working on a follow-up by you and another other reporter for some of the behavior that went on at Amazon under Roy Price, Roy stepped down about 2 hours after I made that call. So the fallout from the Harvey Weinstein scandal has now taken down another executive. And the question now is, who's next?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tricky for us as journalists. If you make a phone call to try to confirm things, you are now lighting a match. And that is a very dicey proposition journalistically. But on the other hand, if you're hearing about serious allegations of misconduct, you don't want to ignore them. So we are in an interesting phase. And so is Amazon Studios, because this behavior was not something that is like a one-off that Roy did at Comic-Con. He had a pattern of trying to guide conversations into sexual areas, always in work settings, but sort of parties connected with work. And I find that in a lot of the allegations I'm hearing, that's where this stuff seems to often happen. You know, there's a party, maybe people drink too much, and suddenly the behavior is completely outside the bounds of what is acceptable or even legal. So at Amazon, you know, we did publish a broader story about what had gone on there, and I think they have a big problem on their hands figuring out how to reset the culture at that studio.
Yeah, and it does bring up this larger issue of why these claims are so pervasive in Hollywood. And you could go back to the very origins of the studios and how the original moguls were kind of thuggish and piggish when it came to women, all the way up to what you just referenced, the fact that this is an industry where the professional and the social often interact. There are drinks meetings and there are film festivals and there's a culture of people going out all the time. And there's all sorts of things that go on. And in this case of Amazon, a lot of this behavior was in these quasi-social settings.
There's also this you know, the culture of power, where money and power are concentrated in the hands of a group of very much predominantly white men. And there's a feeling of entitlement, I think, among these powerful people, where even though, you know, people have been getting harassment training at most corporations for a long time, somehow it's like rules don't apply. Or maybe the sort of person who is driven enough to rise to the top of Hollywood is also a kind of person who happens to have a lot of demons in some cases. And maybe I just should say, this would be true if you started talking about the academic world or any other business world. But certainly it is striking to me how many names are coming up and how many terrible stories we're hearing.
You know, certainly in the case of Harvey Weinstein, this is a sexual predator who was emboldened by the power that he had attained and used that power to cover up his behavior. I mean, what we've seen coming out where he had book deals with various journalists.
He offered me one.
He offered you one. I mean, and he...
I turned it down. I want to be very clear.
Yes. And, you know, he offered to throw parties for different people, and he would use various outlets to smear people that he found were aligned against him. And even when in my interactions with him, where he would call, there was a vaguely threatening tone in almost every conversation we ever had, where he would casually drop, oh, you know, well, I could just buy your magazine and install my own editor, and I know so-and-so, and I could just do this. And you know, there was that culture of intimidation that helped him cover up what was a pattern of behavior here.
Yeah, and on the one side, he could offer you, I could make you a star and you might win an Oscar, as Gwyneth Paltrow did, and she's talked about this. And on the other side, it was like, do you want to take this guy on, get smeared, have lawyers hired against you, a battalion, as he has done now, have you investigated by a private investigator and bring up demons? You know, somebody told me, and I don't know, this is not confirmed, but that a dossier was prepared on one of the reporters who had been looking into Harvey over in recent history and left on the desks of editors at this publication. So that was a carrot and stick that he could offer, you know, to potential performers or directors. And for journalists, you know, the carrot was access to things and special interviews. You know, I recounted in a piece I did for The Hollywood Reporter how I went to a party with my then 12-year-old niece. And before I could open my mouth, Harvey said to her, do you want to meet Orlando Bloom and Johnny Depp? And spirited her through the crowd. And I was just yelling after him, I don't owe you anything. So that was he would throw these little goodies if you were good. And then he would, you know, yell at you like he did with you if you were not good.
Absolutely. And now the irony is this same media establishment is 100% turned against him and is now investigating every little nook and cranny of his life.
And there are many. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Actor Andy Serkis has played many roles in his 20-year-plus career, where he looks like himself. But he's best known for his pioneering roles in performance capture, in which computer technology transforms him into characters like Gollum in the Lord of the Rings movies, the towering King Kong, and the highly evolved Caesar in the recent Planet of the Apes trilogy.
Apes!
In 2011, Serkis and producer Jonathan Cavendish created Imaginarium, a performance capture studio in the UK. They've also made the new film Breathe, with Serkis stepping behind the camera to direct. It's not the kind of movie you'd expect from people focused on new technology. It's an old-fashioned love story starring real humans. For Cavendish, Breathe is a very personal project, the story of his extraordinary parents. Cavendish's father, Robin, was stricken with polio in 1958 and became paralyzed from the neck down, unable to breathe without a ventilator. At the time, few people in that condition lived long, and all were confined to hospitals. Breathe depicts Robin Cavendish's battle to change that. In the film, Andrew Garfield plays Robin, while Claire Foy plays his wife, Diana, who is determined to help him escape.
I either go on living here or leave here and possibly die.
Yes.
What are we waiting for?
Serkis might have wondered if producer Jonathan Cavendish was just pursuing a vanity project about his parents, but in fact, Serkis found much to love, starting with the script.
This one was a story that Jonathan had been wanting to tell for an extraordinarily long period of time. And so Jonathan had been involving it with Bill Nicholson, the great writer.
You went through many drafts, I think, right?
We did, yeah, because it was a great situation. I'd done a movie with Bill, Elizabeth the Golden Age with Cate Blanchett, and I'd seen his play Shadowlands. And that, I think, was the thing that made me reckon I could make a film about my parents, was that writing, the tone and the skill of the writing. So I asked him, I told him the story of my parents' life, and I said, would you write this? And he said, I would write it, but on one condition, and that is that you don't pay me until and unless the film happens.
What was the reservation that he had?
He didn't want anyone else to own it. He didn't want anybody else to be able to make a film about my mother and my father's life without us wanting it to happen. And if money changes hands, there is an ownership issue. So basically what we did was every time that Bill and I were free at the same time, we'd ring one another up and we'd do another draft. And it's a great way of working because you keep putting the thing down and doing something else, and then 3 or 4 months later you come back to it and it's glaringly obvious where the problems are.
Oops, that didn't work. Yeah.
Yeah.
delete.
And Bill's got a brilliant gift of, for a razor sharp minded person, he has a tremendous gift of forgetting. So he would come in and, having been on the train coming up to London, and go, oh my God, the first act's brilliant, but the second act's terrible. And it was great. So it meant that we worked and worked and worked. And then Andy, to my great joy, after we'd started the company, said that he'd like to direct the movie, which was incredibly exciting. And he brought much, much to it. But particularly, he pointed out to me that my parents were pioneers, that they were doing things nobody'd ever done before, which I hadn't realized, really.
That's, when having seen the film, I'd say it's very, that became it.
Yes, it's mm-hmm. a huge part of the story, is that they broke out of hospital in 1960 with a degree of severity of disability that nobody else in the world was living outside of hospital with. And because of the natural modesty and Englishness of my parents, I hadn't realized that that was unusual. Because also, if you're a child and it's your life, it's not unusual. But Andy pointed all of this out to me.
So you're discovering, in a way, your own, the interestingness of your own life.
In many ways, yes, exactly. It wasn't therapy, exactly, because I'd had a very happy childhood. But I did learn a lot of things. I would recommend everybody should make a film about their parents. It's a brilliant thing.
So, Andy, you've been pretty busy since I talked to you when you were in Lord of the Rings some years ago.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be too tedious, but I do feel obligated to ask, you know, what is it about the performance capture? You are the guy.
Well, it's, for me, when I finished Lord of the Rings, and I really did think my career was going to go back to being a relatively conventional stage actor, screen actor, and, you know, eventually I'd started wanting to make things and direct things. But it was really at the end of The Return of the King, when Peter Jackson said to me, do you want to play King Kong? And I thought, oh, what are you talking about? You know, and this is an extraordinary thing. But and then I realized that it was literally a major sort of epiphany, really, that I'd just been playing this 3.5-foot ring junkie, and now I'm going to be playing a 25-foot gorilla. This is surely the end of typecasting. And that's what I literally felt about a performance capture, that it was this 21st century actor's tool that would allow you to play anything regardless of what size you are, what your face looks like, what shape you are, what sex you are. It's this thing that enables you to completely transport yourself into any character. So that's why it's held a fascination for me over the years. And now, 17 years later, you know, continue to want to push and develop that art, because it actually now, having been through lots of different sort of technical innovations and freeing from ever having to shoot just in a motion capture studio, or, you know, shooting and then having to repeat things, the technology allows you to exist as a character with your fellow actors on a film set halfway up a mountain, and, you know, the connection between you and the other actors is exactly the same as it would be if I was wearing a costume and makeup and performing against another actor. And it's reached this point in this really wonderful place where you can not only use it for films, but for TV projects, for video games, for augmented reality and virtual reality. But also, like, for instance, last year we worked on a theatrical production with the Royal Shakespeare Company, where on stage we had an actor playing Ariel in The Tempest in a motion capture suit projected into various different avatars, shape-shifting between them in real time on stage.
To project it onto the stage.
Mm. So it continues to fascinate me and us. And, you know, through Jungle Book, the Jungle Book that we have been making, to Animal Farm, which we're evolving, through to other projects in the future. It just, this sense of true performance, the essence of performance, being able to be played out by actors with each other and then to be translated into these extraordinary other beings.
Do you prefer one way or the other now?
No, not at all. I mean, I love acting conventionally. I love being on screen where you can see my face and embodying a character that is putting on a costume and going, oh, wow, gosh, you know, this costume makes me feel like this. And in a, you know, much more conventional way, I don't ever and never have drawn a distinction.
I do kind of wonder why you're so damn good at it.
I don't know. I mean, I think one thing is you have to not be afraid. You have to be quite fearless, I suppose, because you have to trust that your performance is going to translate. You have to be not vain, because you're not going to see your face on screen, and you have to be able to put years and years of work into it.
I wonder if having a particularly mobile face is part of the thing. I mean, you guys do this technically. Does that help or no?
It depends on the character, really. It's not about pantomiming anything or overly physicalizing. I mean, we were talking about apes earlier. You know, that there's a lot of this last Apes movie, which is completely internalized. It's all about the close-ups.
Yeah.
And so it's truly acting and internalizing and allowing those emotions to play as if you were holding a close-up conventionally.
So be honest. If Jonathan says to you, I just really want to make this movie about my parents, is there a part of you that thinks, oh God, I have to be nice about this and run?
Oh, the absolute opposite. I mean,
I'm so cynical. I'm such a bad person.
No. I mean, we were literally kind of evolving our other projects when I read the script for Breathe, and I was so moved by it.
And I was slightly surprised. I was totally thrilled, but I was slightly surprised because it was outside what one might think was his sort of central area of interest. But the great thing is it reinforces what we are as a company. I mean, just this month we have a scary movie coming out in England called The Ritual, where we've created a creature in our studio. And we have Breathe coming out in the States. And we have a Planet of the Apes universe video game that we've made coming out in a couple of weeks' time. And Jungle Book that's coming out next year. And I think that just goes to the breadth of what Andy does and the things that I'm interested in. And it's typical of him to be fascinated in, you know, what is a classic love story and a classic story of triumph over adversity.
I was just going to say triumph, exactly that.
Yeah.
So Andy, I'm just going to pause for a second on Jungle Book, because it's come up already a couple of times. And that's really the first movie you directed, but it hasn't been released. You've watched Disney jump all over the Jungle Book IP, although it's public domain, I suppose, and you're gestating your Jungle Book. If you just found a way to say that's theirs and this is mine and it's not going to be confusing to the public and I'm okay with this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're very different films. And, you know, there was a time when we were both kind of neck and neck, you know, both studios
yes,
were making them at the same time. And actually the hiatus that we've taken in post-production, because so we'd shot principal photography with our cast, and of course we're using performance capture technology. So ours differs in a way that it's live action for a start. So we shot in South Africa and we shot on location and we shot at Leeson Studios, so it's a very real physical jungle. It's also, all of the animals are played by actors on set.
Shere Khan will look like a tiger.
He'll look like a tiger, but he also looks like Benedict Cumberbatch. But crucially, it's much more sort of performance driven. It is like a drama, just the actors happen to be animals.
The tone is
a slightly darker. It's closer, I think, in tone
to Rudyard Kipling.
To Kipling's mm-hmm. book. It's for a slightly older audience, and crucially, it's a Mowgli-centric story. So it's about identity.
I was such a fan of that book when I was younger.
As you will remember, there's a darkness in it.
There's all sorts of things in it. Yeah,
we'd done all that and shot all that when we had this post-production, long period of post-production where our facial and animation was starting to come in, but we decided to hold off a little bit, let the Disney film have its moment. And then
jump out again with another one.
Yeah, but in the meantime, we were lucky enough to have this window of opportunity to shoot Breathe mm-hmm. with Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy and their availability, and we kind of jumped on it.
We literally had, from the time we decided to make it, we had 7 weeks to raise the money and prepare the film before we shot it for 7 weeks, and then Andrew and Claire were off and we had to go back and do our other movie.
Coming up after a short break, director Andy Serkis and producer Jonathan Cavendish talk about why Andrew Garfield wanted a mold of the producer's teeth for his starring role in Breathe. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to actor and director Andy Serkis and producer Jonathan Cavendish about their new film, Breathe, based on the story of Jonathan's parents, Robin and Diana. Robin was stricken with polio at age 28, while Diana was pregnant with Jonathan. Doctors told Robin, played in the film by Andrew Garfield, that he would never leave his hospital bed. But Robin and Diana, played by Claire Foy, were determined to create a life for themselves at home, where their son could grow up around his father.
Look, Jonathan. It's Daddy.
Hello, Jonathan. Hello, dear boy.
Breathe is the first film Serkis has directed to hit theaters, though it's not technically his directorial debut. He's been at work on a long-gestating performance capture version of The Jungle Book, not from Disney, but from Warner Brothers. That film is still in post-production. Serkis found that directing a traditional live-action film, like Breathe, had some benefits.
In many ways, that was the joy of being able to look at the end of the day's shooting and see what you had in the can and go, oh, wow, I don't have to wait a year and a half to see what this is going to look like. So right. In many ways, I was very relaxed about it because I was just there watching these incredible performances.
Although I would say that it was like watching somebody who was making their 20th film, not their first or second film. And he's one of those people who quietly does watch what's going on everywhere. So he's worked on so many movies with so many great directors that he came with an incredibly put-together kit in his head of how to make a film, but also how specifically to make this film. And watching him do The Jungle Book and watching him do Breathe, two very, very different films, you know, he's made them in very specific ways, tailored to the material for each. So I've worked with a lot of directors and a lot of first-time directors, but I've never worked with a first-time director who actually is a 20th-time director. That was a new experience.
So you, of course, are born in this film.
Yes.
And it's kind of a strange thing, I would think, to say, I'm going to cast me.
Yeah, well, the casting of me was the one bit of the film I didn't have anything to do with, actually.
Oh, good. Did you recuse yourself because of conflict?
I excused myself entirely. And when we first started out, Bill wanted to make it a film about the father's relationship with the son. And I saw it as not that. I saw it as what interested me was the love story. And that's one of the things I wanted to get across in the movie that Andy and the actors have done so brilliantly, is that closeness of relationship that allows them to, once my father had got over a very profound 2-year depression in hospital where he wanted somebody to turn his machine off because he couldn't do it for himself. As soon as my mother persuaded him round and they left hospital, he never had a day's depression. He never looked back. He always looked forward. And that, to me, even I as a child who was there, realized that was pretty remarkable.
So your mom is still in the world. Did she support this from the jump, or was she saying, oh, honey, darling, please no, don't, let's do that?
She absolutely presumed that it would never happen.
Well, I think that was very sensible of her, based on how this business
is. Well, quite. I've talked to her a number of times about movies I'm particularly excited about that never happened. So when it hoved into view as a reality, she did get a little bit nervous, but she knows Andy very well and trusts him. And she met Andrew and Claire and was absolutely bowled over by them, loved them. So we made the film, and she was a little bit taken aback that we were actually making it. She came on the first day of filming and left after half an hour saying it was the most boring thing she'd ever seen in her life.
Well, that's any film that you ever watched. Yes.
Didn't come and see us again. And then when the film was being edited, I showed her a sort of 5-minute clip to get her into the process of trying to get used to the
Brace
fact
yourself.
That she was going to be on a big screen. And I said to her, just don't say anything. Just please just watch it for 6 minutes and then we'll talk. And she got to minute 3 and she pointed at the screen accusing you. She said, I would never have worn that hat.
But she should have said, but I am gorgeous.
Yes, yes. Well, she was and in fact still is. So she would that,
there
with that
go,
bit
perfect
didn't,
casting.
Didn't surprise her. But she, thank goodness, she loves the film. She absolutely loves the film.
And in terms of Andrew, one peculiar thing is that he had a cast made of your teeth, Jonathan.
That is correct. Poor man, can you imagine? He had to wear my teeth for 7 weeks. And it's the sort of particular and specific attention to detail that Andrew has when he's preparing for a part. So
was he studying photographs of your father?
He studied photographs, footage. He talked to lots of people who knew my father. He spent a gigantic amount of time cramming himself with the detail of what would make a person who was born at that time in the particular circumstances that he was, the able-bodied version, and then again a whole set of separate research about how it would be to be completely paralyzed and to only be able to emote and communicate with your face while being driven by an air pump that is driving air in and out of your lungs through a hole in your throat, which dictates how and when you speak. And one of the things that Andrew picked up that my father used to do, because there would be a pause
right. As
the bellows corrected themselves.
We saw that with Christopher Reeves as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And my father used to get fed up of people finishing his sentences for him in this gap. So he would always use an unpredictable word at the end of each phrase, so nobody knew what was coming.
Couldn't quite anticipate.
And Andrew, being an immensely, incredibly clever person, started doing it himself in his own natural speech as well as him as Robin. So the two people, as happens often with great actors, kind of collided and elided.
Must have been rather difficult for him to be in the chair all the time when you were filming.
He and Claire had this sort of pact at the beginning that he would be tended to. You know, he would stay in the chair and that she would look after him in between takes, particularly in the Oxford Hospital section, the front end of the movie. He actually didn't move out of bed for practically a week. When
I'm just going to go there and say, including bathroom runs?
Yeah, well, that excluded. But,
okay, thank you.
But he went there, he really did, and he really kind of lost himself in that depression.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he really, really put himself into it. But there was immense trust between them, and that was really... It is rare that I think you see chemistry at that level on screen between actors. You know, they really did feed off each other.
So, you know, it's a conventional film in the sense that it's not a comic book movie. It's the sort of film that's been having a hard time, movies for grown-ups. But you guys are going for the full gamut, this company, I guess.
Well, it's about the collective experience, isn't it, cinema? And, you know, we are involved, lucky enough to be involved in very big movies, tentpoles, and, you know, we believe in all sorts of things. But there is a huge place for films that are very emotional and that allow you to have a collective emotional experience, which this film seems very much to deliver, particularly when it's combined with a lot of laughter. We've had a huge amount of feedback from people going, ooh, I've just slightly changed my view of the world watching this film. We had a kids screening in London, an education screening, and that came out really loud and clear. The kids all said, we're told our lives are circumscribed and reduced and you grown-ups have messed up our world and everything. And now we look at this film and actually we've got all of our hope back. And that's a great feeling. And I think that, you know, making a film like that once in a while is a great thing to do. Because you can feel in the room when people watch the film, you can feel a huge emotional well. And that's a wonderful thing.
Old-fashioned but wonderful.
Yeah.
And so, Andy, you played the saxophone in the film soundtrack. You're a good saxophone player.
I'm an all right saxophone player. I'm good enough. And Nitin Sawhney, who's our composer, I've known for many years and we have played together. But yeah, he asked me if I'd play. I was sort of saying I really want a woodwind instrument in there, which is to do with breath, you know. And so I did a pass of the theme that he'd written on the sax, which he's used in the opening credits.
Amazing. Andy Serkis is the director, and Jonathan Cavendish is the producer of Breathe. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from J.C. Swadek and Phil Richards. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.